Larry. Fucking Larry.
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 Larry. Larry, get into bed now.
Christmas is only 15 days away. 15 days. When I was a kid, a small kid, like anywhere from 3 or 4 to maybe 9 or 10, I could barely contain my excitement by now. For a lot of kids, it was about the presents. Television was saturated with the latest crap from Hasbro and Mattel, seducing young minds to the chagrin of their parents. But few things I saw on TV really grabbed me. Maybe at some basic level, I recognized most toys for the junk they were. And that pretty much every toy had a limited life cycle, or really two limited life cycles. The first was how long it would last before breaking, the second being how long before boredom would set in and the toy would be forgotten. Right off the bat, all the stuff for girls was just a colossal bore, or something to be mocked. Dolls, for instance. And they made dolls that would pee their pants. My brother and I thought that was pretty funny. Baby Piss-a-Lot, or whatever they called it. For us, toys were for one thing and one thing only. Fun. Baby Piss-a-Lot was like a toy that assigned homework. I guess all those little girls with latent maternal instincts were buying Baby Piss-a-Lot. And I do recall girls in school complaining that there wasn't enough homework. Then there was Barbie. I doubt she was looking for more homework. I always watched Barbie commercials. I didn't realize it as a 7-year-old, but Barbie was damn pointy. I wasn't the only male studying Barbie. Some college guys scaled her up and determined that if Barbie were an actual woman, she would be 5'9" tall, have a majestic 39-inch bust, a waspy 18-inch waist, 33-inch hips, and a size 3 shoe. But then those numbers were disputed because they scaled Barbie while wearing her customary high heels. Barefoot Barbie, as a real woman, would only be 5'6". When those computations were first done, it was for the hell of it, and the results were meant to amuse. Then Barbie's measurements became politicized and a bludgeon for the patriarchy. Ooh. They say she'd be a candidate for anorexia. I'd say she'd be a candidate for having a male harem. For years, they've blamed Barbie for women growing up with unrealistic and unhealthy beauty ideals. Their words, not mine. They shitlisted Barbie for essentially being too good-looking. Ironically, Barbie was created by a business woman, Ruth Handler. She did it to show little girls that they could be anything they wanted to be, that a woman has choices. But apparently, a hot little wasp waist is not an approved choice by the chronically envious. A few years ago, Mattel, which has made over $3 billion on Barbie since she was created in 59, they came out with Curvy Barbie to give all those young girls something more realistic to play with. And sales plummeted. Curvy Barbie wasn't so healthy for Mattel's bottom line. Barbie's boyfriend Ken looked pretty much like Barbie, but with short hair and no breasts. To fix that, they put a beard on Ken. But when they were together, Barbie looked like the beard. In 1993, Mattel's market research indicated that Ken needed a makeover, so they created Earring Magic Ken. He has become a case study for marketing disasters. To determine what young hip dudes were wearing so they could dress Ken as cool as possible, Mattel sent their crack marketing team to a gay rave. So Ken debuted wearing a purple pleather vest, a mesh shirt, and a very suggestive piece of body jewelry on a lanyard around his neck. Magic Earring Ken didn't sell so well to preteen girls, but he was a smash hit among gay guys with a sense of humor. The Barbie that really grabbed me was Malibu Barbie. Although I had never visited even as a tyke, I was jonesing for the West Coast. And here was this pointy plastic chick, now with a golden tan. She cruised around in a convertible Vette. Or maybe it was a Jeep, I'm not sure. But she had a swimming pool, and there were palm trees and sunshine. I wasn't thinking about girlfriends yet, but if I had one, Malibu Barbie would have been it. In Queens, New York, or anywhere that winter howls, they'd have had to invent Christmas as a hedge against severe depression. December in Queens was monochromatic. Endless variations of gray. Gray asphalt, gray concrete, even the red bricks of the apartment buildings, once soaked with sleet, would turn a shade of gray. When it would snow, which was initially a source of joy, that snow would quickly turn to gray slush. But Christmas took the edge off all that gray and gloom. My ardor, my enthusiasm for Christmas was powerful, and it really wasn't the stuff, the gifts. In our house, there was never, ever a Christmas list. That would have sucked the magic out of it and made you a spoiled and greedy little prick. You just hoped that Santa Claus, we never called him Santa, always Santa Claus, you hoped he would somehow divine what would make you smile and then hope for the best. My brother always wanted toy guns, and he got plenty of them. Cap guns and dart guns, and one year, oh, these fantastic six guns that looked and operated like the real McCoy. They were not some cheap shit plastic. These babies were metal. You could have pistol-whipped someone unconscious with one, no problem. They were revolvers with a real cylinder that spun with those satisfying precision clicks. And each chamber of the cylinder held a spring-loaded plastic bullet. When you pulled the trigger, that bullet would exit the barrel with surprising velocity. It would perforate a few sheets of loose leaf clear across the room. It would put a nice, deep dent in the skin of an apple. Well, it wasn't long before I took one of those rounds in my eye. It wasn't intentional. My brother was just doing some quick draw stuff. Well, the old man, he kind of snapped. He took my brother's entire arsenal of toy ordnance down to the basement and smashed it to bits with a masonry hammer. My eye recovered, but that cool toy gun collection was gone forever. To me, I was a knife guy. Guns were okay, but you might run out of ammo, like those poor bastards at the Alamo. But not Jim Bowie. That pig sticker he carried enabled him to kill and kill again. I always wanted a Bowie knife. They looked so cool with that enormous blade and those curvy quillons. I always assumed Jim Bowie designed that big shiv, but it was actually made by his brother, Resin, who gifted it to Jim after he got shot in a fight. Now, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense until you get into the details. Turns out there was a duel. Neither of the combatants could manage to shoot the other, so they shook hands and walked away. However, each had an entourage, and somebody in one group pegged a shot at the other, and then it was on. The lead flew, and Jim Bowie was shot through a lung. He must have been one tough son of a bitch because he managed to draw his big blade and shove it through the heart of the shooter, killing him instantly. I guess some guys can bring a knife to a gunfight and win. Like James Coburn did in The Magnificent Seven. I'll post that classic clip on the show page. So for me, it was the idea of Christmas that thrilled me, much more than the gifts. The notion of some fat guy in a red fur suit coming down the chimney, even though we had no chimney. It was just pure magic. Across the street from our tiny clapboard house, there was a Methodist church. And every Christmas, the pastor of that church would hang a big, blue-lighted five-point star up on the steeple. I stared at that star, night after night, all through the Christmas seasons. It was his version of the Star of Bethlehem, I suppose. It threw that shade of twilight blue that always seems to accompany magic. That blue star affected me so strongly, I built a replica of it myself, and you can see it on the show page at thatlarryshow.com. Kids have a knack for projecting their fantasies over reality, at least for brief interludes. Daydreaming, I guess, even at night. I hitched my mind to that star, and it took me to a place I'd never been, and a time I'd missed by more than a century. The land of Currier and Ives. It was rural Americana Christmas of the late 19th century, and not Appalachia either. It was country abundance. No concrete, no asphalt, no bricks, no subways, no police sirens, no 6 o'clock news with the latest mayhem, no gray slush, no school and no homework. It was a place of woods and open fields covered with pristine snow, lit by a soft focus full moon. A sprawling two-story home stood on acres and acres with no other house in sight. It had a wraparound porch and split-rail fences. A candle glowed invitingly in every dormered window. Several horse-drawn sleighs gathered in front where guests were entering the home. What was it like inside that home? Of course there'd be a roaring fire and a table laid with a ham and a goose and a turkey and every conceivable treat. There would be wing-backed chairs with guys smoking long clay pipes, and one of them would be reading The Night Before Christmas. Some gorgeous woman would see me standing slack-jawed and take me by the hand and lead me to that table and pile a plate high for me as she told me all the festivities planned for the evening. And she was so delighted I could join them and had the stable boy taken my horse to the barn. She was so stunning and kind, I could barely find my voice. It was the blue star that led me to the home's interior. The perspective of those lithographs are always from a considerable distance. You can never make out anyone's face. Such was the brilliance of Currier and Ives. That distance allowed me and everyone who viewed those images to imagine themselves as a part of them and to wander within them with no fear of being challenged by the legitimate and permanent residents. I'd always thought Currier and Ives prints were some fine art for rich guys. Turns out the two of them were business geniuses. Not really great artists, but great marketers. They hired fine artists like Thomas Nast to do original work. Then they mass-produced prints as black and white lithographs that were hand-colored. Their idyllic depictions were created specifically for people like me, city dwellers, hankering for a place we could only visit in our mind's eye. Initially, the company called itself the Grand Central Depot for cheap and popular prints. They were sold everywhere for anywhere from a nickel to $3 a copy. Hardly the stuff of kings. But they fueled a lot of visions among the common folk. Although there were no fireplaces or sleighs or split-rail fences or country roads, I never felt even a little bit deprived at Christmas. Our bellies were always full. We were always warm. My parents loved each other, and me and my brother. Plenty of kids I trudged to school with on sub-zero days over icy sidewalks. They did so with silver dollar-sized holes in their shoe soles and threadbare coats with busted zippers or missing buttons. They try to clutch their jacket closed with one hand while carrying books with the other. Some of their dads were drunks, some were in jail, and some were just missing. Those kids had it tough. We always had a beautiful tree, usually a Douglas fir. Acquiring that tree was a ritual that I looked forward to every year. It was man's work, and it seemed we did it at night. Mom never accompanied us. After dinner, the old man would announce it was time to get a tree. My brother and I would pile into the Ford or Chevy. Dad would fire up the motor and then attack the windshield with an ice scraper as we huddled inside. Once he had cleared the window, he'd get back in and shove the heater switch to high and defrost. Then he'd put it in gear and we'd hear those Goodyear all-weather radials crunch over the ice as he pulled into the road. In New York back then, Christmas trees were sold on the street, often by guys who may have been on parole. They invariably wore hoodies, knit caps, and had lit cigarettes that never left their lips, even while they talked. They'd find an empty lot, string some rope between two buildings or some fence posts, and lay the bound trees against it. Very often there was an old 55-gallon oil drum filled with burning scrap wood. They'd warm their hands over it until a customer arrived. Dad would walk up and down the row of trees and point to one about the right height and have the guy cut the twine binding it. Then he'd stand it up and pull the branches down to see if it was full enough. He'd spin it around to be sure it wasn't bald on one side. Then he'd find a flaw, a bald spot, or a brown branch and point it out to the guy. That was bargaining leverage. Eventually, they'd arrive at a price. The old man would pull a blanket from the trunk, spread it on the roof to protect the paint job, and we'd help him lash it to the car. Bringing that tree into our little house was nearly as thrilling as waking up Christmas morning. The pine scent was Christmas itself. I'd stick my face into the branches and inhale. Dad would rig the lights first, and everyone would hang the ornaments and garland and tinsel. Of course, Dad placed the tree topper. Some people had stars, some had angels. We had that pointy thing. It was cool and symmetrical and gave the tree even more height. There were a lot of glass ornaments that had those corrugated indentations in them. I enjoyed fitting my thumbs into those indentations, and sometimes I used a little too much pressure and pop, my thumb would go right through. I recall Dad looking at a broken one and saying they must have been cheap crap. I never told him I was the culprit. One Christmas, Santa Claus brought a set of Lionel trains, which were assembled around the tree. Man, was that fun. That big Bakelite transformer would hum and buzz, and the locomotive would start to race around. Of course, we put stuff in its way. Toy soldiers, or little plastic cows or horses. When the train slammed into them, we'd do horse or cow screams and laugh like hell. Then there came a certain Christmas. I must have been 10 or 11. That January, we would be moving from the tiny clapboard house to a bigger, fancier house a few miles away. New school and everything. I was not the least bit happy about it. My father knew it and kept telling me the new house had a fireplace, knowing how much I dug fireplaces. That year, Santa Claus delivered two beautiful, shiny, 3-speed bicycles. It didn't snow Christmas Day. It rained. And it seemed it would never stop raining. The bicycles were put in the basement until the weather improved. It was torture looking at that bike and not being able to jump on it and go. But that's life in New York in winter. The night before the move, I had a lump in my throat that would not go away. The blue star still hung on the church steeple. I looked at it through the steamy window and knew we'd never ride together again. That evening it was tilted, as if nodding goodbye. The twilight sky color of it had always been magical, but that night it seemed dimmer, darker, smaller, and sad. The next morning it still rained. I watched the movers load all our stuff into the truck, including my new bike, which I had yet to ride. Before my parents locked the front door for the last time, I ran back inside for a final look. I had a nickel in my pocket. I stood in the kitchen doorway, and on the door jamb was an open metal striker. I don't know why, but I took that nickel and dropped it into the hole. I heard it tumble down and come to rest somewhere on the floorboards. Some of the best times of my young life happened within the narrow walls of that old house. Maybe the nickel was some small payment, a thank you for a wonderful childhood. There have been a lot of Christmases since that rainy one, and many a move, one big one clear across the continent. I still haven't met Malibu Barbie. However, there are many Botoxed facsimiles here in the San Fernando Valley. Plenty of earring magic Kens walking around too. I've covered a lot of miles over the years, but still haven't found that Currier and Ives perfect rural American Christmas estate. But I'm pretty sure the guy with the long clay pipe will be sitting in front of the fire reading a story this December 24th. Maybe I'll step outside that evening and stare at my blue star and see if it might take me there just for old time's sake. Hey, thanks for hanging with me once again. It's always great to be with you. Be sure to stop by the show page for all those images I mentioned. Go to thatlarryshow.com. And if you feel like it, click the Patreon button to help me keep the lanterns lit here. There you'll find dozens of bonus episodes, signed books, custom recordings, and more. Follow the show on Twitter and Facebook. Just plug That Larry Show into the search bar. And you can always email me at thatlarryshow@gmail.com. Big announcement, I may be doing a first in the next episode or two, and that is having a guest, a very, very famous guest, who will hold you spellbound. I can't confirm it just yet, but when it happens, it will be extraordinary. So stay tuned on Twitter and Facebook. I'll see you soon.